Lord be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to St. Mark. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he replied, "What do you wish me to do for you?" And they answered him, "Grant that in your glory we may sit one at your right and the other at your left." Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized in the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We can." Jesus said to them, "The cup I drink of you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But as to sitting at my right or my left, that is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." When the 10 heard this, they became indignant at James and John. And Jesus summoned them and said, "You know that those who are recognized as rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones make their authority felt. It shall not be that way with you. Rather, whoever wishes to be great among you will be the servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you will be the slave of all. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." The Gospel of the Lord. So I'm wondering how many of you availed of the opportunity during the course of the week, which I challenged you to look at last week, to allow him to look at you with love. Just as the rich young man who came up to him and said, "What must I do to inherit life?" And Jesus said, "You got to let go of your attachment." In his case, it was the attachment to his possessions. And as you allow him to look at you with love, suggested an hour during the week, that'd be one out of 168 hours, maybe 10 minutes for 6 days, or 15 minutes for four. But reflecting on that question, as I allow the Lord to look at me with love, what is that like? And what one thing might he invite me to change in my life? I'd like to, again, look at the idea of the coin. I know you are very familiar. We've talked about it a few weeks, but how important it is to realize the value of both sides. Can never overemphasize the importance of that. That we look at both sides. We get a balance by seeing both sides. In fact, a lot of the news in our world, if you look at it, newscasters generally don't relay or tell the news. They shape the news. And it comes from a particular perspective or agenda, depending on what source you are watching or offering. And I often wonder, why is that the case? Could it be because of our conditioning, our growing up experience, our life experience, that we are so conditioned to many things, and maybe psychologically the opportunity for the media to take advantage of that is significant. You know, from the time we were growing up, we have had a conditioning, a practice. We are told what to do, how to do, when to do it, and all of the realities of that. When I was growing up in my own home, in my school, my church, I was always told what to do, how to do it, and when to do it. And I was conditioned by my family in terms of the experiences of how to behave, how to respond, how to act, how to believe, and how to live life. And I'm sure most of us have had a sense of that experience. We have a lot of conditioning. I remember an event when I was in high school. My classmates would start off, when there was no teacher there, they'd start off a litany of the saints. Saint Peter, pray for us. Saint James, pray for us. Saint Paul, pray for us. And on Saint Bartholomew and Saint Barnabas. And then they would say Saint Louis de Montfort. That was a kind of a striking one. And people would say, who in the heck is Louis de Montfort? Today you could Google it rather easily. Back then we didn't have those luxuries. But what they were doing was having a little play on the rosary in my home, because in the rosary we had the full litany of the saints. And it was common among my peers in class to say, hey, have you ever been subjected to the rosary in Doubler's house? That was a little nickname, another day's work. And they would say, have you ever been through it? Man, it's so long. 23 minutes it took. They had a time down to an issue. But it was very common for us growing up to have the family rosary. And when I went to my friends' homes, joined in the family rosary as they were having it, and everybody was expected. The doorbell rang, whoever it was, if it was a neighbor looking for something, they were encouraged to come in and join the rosary. It was an integral part of that growing up. But I noticed the difference between the rosary in my home, and that's why my friends had a good little chuckle out of it. My friends' homes took 8 to 12 minutes. So the difference in the rosary in my home and in many of theirs was like 10 to 15 minutes. That was a little significant. So I thought one day, well, I'd suggest to my dad, maybe we could cut it down a little and be like my friends. I thought, good idea. Turned out not to be such a great idea. You know, he had a response to it in kind. He said, basically, if you like it that much, why don't you go ahead and move over to Tony's? I explained to him, at Tony's house, it takes 8.5 minutes and his mother allows us all to kneel on the chairs. That's because they were country people and the floor was different. And I thought, hey, that's a cool idea. Just kneel up on the chairs and do the response and knock out the rosary. My friend Tony caught on to the rosary in our house, so he called me up about 30 minutes ahead of time. He said, get the rosary started and I'll be there to pick you up close to the end. But I suggested to my dad an idea of changing, and nothing could have prepared me for the response. Hey, just go ahead and move and join him. That was the way we did things. In a way, it was saying, hey, there are two choices on the menu, something that we say quite often, you can take it or leave it. But life is much more than that. Life is much more than just the two choices. It could be saying there are two sides to the coin, choose one, and quite often that is what we do. But thank God, I realize today, hey, that's not very helpful. There are two sides, and it really benefits us and enriches our lives by being able to see two sides. And so the idea, as we said before, two sides to the coin, which forms a unity in that reality. So if one side is life, the other side is, pardon? Death. That's good. And if one side is love, the other side is apathy. That's what we suggested, because apathy keeps more people out of love than anything else in the world. We might be inclined to think it's hatred would be the other side, but no, that's a totally separate emotion that engages us. And if one side is light, then the other side is darkness. And if one side is transfer, by transfer I mean passing on, pass to another person, what might the other side be? Pardon? Holding on to, resisting? Possibly. I'd like you to think about if one side is to transfer, the other side is to transform. It's an important piece of what I'm talking about today. And if one side is suffering, the other side is joy in the gospel terms. That's what I'd like to look at. If we don't have a balance between light and darkness in our lives, then we have a tendency to see things only as light. And we can become really disappointed and disillusioned in that reality. If my tendency is to avoid suffering at all costs and to only experience joy all of the time, I'm going to be pretty disappointed and I may not experience a great deal of joy. And if I have a tendency to transfer my pain or my suffering rather than transform it, I'm going to be very limited in life. It's just an integral part of the experience of life. Because if I transfer it and always find somebody else to blame for whatever suffering or experience I'm having in life, then I'm always chasing that reality. Who's to blame? That individual, that group, that gathering, that organization, or maybe even God himself. Why is God permitting this to happen? And that's a very deep and valuable question. It's an integral part of the Christian experience. And somehow we sometimes sit and we demand of God almost an explanation. Why are you doing this to me, God? Why are you letting this happen to me? And what happens if I transfer my pain all of the time, then I'm always pointing out there and saying, if it weren't for him, God, or anybody else, or that individual, or that group, or that organization, then I wouldn't be feeling this way. Richard Rohr, in his reflections this week, talked a whole lot, all week long, from Sunday through Saturday, about suffering, the importance of suffering in the Christian life, and how valuable it is to work at integrating it. He talked about the without the cross, there is no resurrection. That it's an integral part of the Christian experience. And while we tend to look at suffering or darkness as something to be avoided at all costs, it is an integral part of our experience. That's what this is about, the crucifixion, and then the hope of life. But we have a tendency from our earliest days to try and avoid sickness and pain of all kinds, whether it's emotional, physical, psychological pain, even death itself. We would like to avoid the reality. But deep down in our spirits, we know that's not possible. Death is the great equalizer. It's going to visit everybody. Everybody. Richard Rohr quoted the Irish social psychologist Dermot O'Murricu, Dermot Murphy in English, and he says, "Creation cannot survive, and less so thrive, without its dark side." What a profound truth. Two sides. There is a quality of destruction, decay, and death that is essential to creation's flourishing. We know that to be true. We look at the seasons outside and we see it most clearly. Every year, the changes, and then there are annuals that come back again, and there is that constant process of dying and rising again, and then rebirth. We know it. It happens in us as well. And then Dermot O'Murricu says, "And the consequence of this destructive dimension is what we call evil, pain, and suffering." Obviously, he said, I'm not suggesting fatalistic acquiescence. Indeed, he said, I am arguing for the very opposite. An enduring sense of hope, which it seems to me is not possible without first coming to terms with the paradox. Two sides, both of them integrated. Suffering and joy, life and death, darkness and light. It is He says, the unfolding cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. We see it all of the time. And quite often, we don't experience the rebirth because we stay stuck in death. He said, and it transpires over all of creation in the macro and micro scales alike. Yes, suffering is an integral part of life. And for a Christian, it is a very integral part. And if I'm really going to understand my being engaged in Christianity, then suffering is an integral part of that reality. It's what Jesus calls the carrying of the cross. And I thought today's gospel was a great subtle reminder of that reality. Here is Jesus, absolutely focused on heading to Jerusalem. He's telling the apostles, all 12, I've got to go to Jerusalem and there I will suffer. Two chapters ago, back in Mark chapter 8, we read, he then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. That was a pretty important teaching. It was a very important teaching. And the apostles seemed to be clueless in the face of that. Here, right after that, two of them are asking, hey, got a little request, Jesus, could we see one on your right and the other on your left? Jesus responds, you've no idea what you're asking. Do you not know what you are asking? And he says, the cup I drink, can you drink the cup? The baptism with which I am baptized, can you be baptized with that? Immersed into the life of what it means to be a Christian? And they say, yeah, sure we can. And we say, sure we can. We can drink the cup and we can be baptized in the baptism. But as to sitting at your right and your left, it's interesting the little storm that it causes for the 10. Doesn't it always happen? The 10 become indignant and they say, who in the heck do they think they are? Why in the world should they be so high and mighty and we've been here all the time with them? That's a kind of a common one in life. Who in the world do they think they are? Why do they think that they should have a greater share than we have? We've been with him as long as they have. In fact, some of us have been here longer than them. You don't hear us asking for special privileges. Maybe. Maybe. But the irony of it is we all know how to work on our own particular agenda and our own needs. And in fact, even if manipulating, we know how to accomplish it and how to get it done. But if you look very closely at the episode, it's very real. What the two disciples were asking really wasn't way out of place. It's something that perhaps we all ask for. I know I certainly have asked for it at times. Lord, would you ever confirm this plan? Would you ever let me know, give me an assurance or a surety? That's what they were doing. Lord, would you let us know that we're going to be right there in the kingdom? Hey, left and right and up front and all of that. Would you give us an assurance? We thrive on assurances. And so it delves them into a real conversation with Jesus. Jesus is saying, in essence, folks, brothers, he pulls them aside, it says, and he began to speak to them. He said, hey, you got to have a different way of operating. Your way of doing, your way of dealing with each other, it's called in the gospel terms metanoia. You got to have a change of heart, a change of attitude. He summons them, sits them down, and he said, with the Gentiles, you know how they lord it over. Those who are in authority can't be that way with you. He said, what you're asking for is assurance. What I am offering you is faith. If I grant your wishes, then there is essentially no need for faith. Because if you have all of the knowledge, then you are the little God. But this is a journey of faith, not of assurances. And the question he is essentially asking, would you trade faith for knowledge? And I would have to say, maybe. In fact, in irrational moments, I would say, yes, certainly, I would trade faith for knowledge. Because I have such an addiction or an attachment to knowing the outcomes before they come about. And so Jesus journeys on toward Jerusalem with the apostles, aware that they still had a lot to learn. And he's saying, you can't be wrangling among yourselves in this way. You got to trust me. I have a plan. It is coming to fruition and fulfillment. Reminded me of a great poem that I remember from my seminary days. Helen Steiner Rice, that wonderful writer. She has an excellent integration of the Christian experience. And she has a poem titled, Life is a Mixture of Sunshine and Rain. Life is a mixture of sunshine and rain, laughter and teardrops, pleasure and pain. Low tides and high tides and mountains and plains, triumphs, defeats and losses and gains. But always in all ways, God's guiding and leading, and he alone knows the things we're most needing. And when he sends sorrow or some dreaded affliction, be assured that it comes with God's kind benediction. And if we accept it as a gift of his love, we'll be showered with blessings from our Father above. That's pretty insightful. I'd like to invite you this week to reflect on the question. Regarding suffering in my life as a Christian, my question is, with all of my knowledge, with all of my education, with all of my conditioning and all of my experience in life, am I more prone to transfer suffering and pain or transform it? The only real experience for the Christian is transforming that pain.